Spiritualism does not propose to wage war against the churches, or against the members composing the churches, but it does propose to wage war against the darkness within the churches, that which belongs particularly to the churches, not the outside acts of individual members. Spiritualism does not tell you to blame the church because one of its members commits murder or any other crime. No, it advises to no such course. Now your querist asks why spiritualists do thus and so. Well, they do so because they are ignorant of the better way, spiritually ignorant. They do not see that in this course they are following directly in the wake of theological darkness and bigotry. They fail to see that they are enacting over and over again what they condemn in others. If they did see it, they would be ashamed for themselves. They would turn from the course, knowing it was not the better way. Spiritualists, those even who have only the outside of spiritualism, who know nothing of its inner life, even that class who only make a profession of belief in the return of dead men, women, and children, should be exceedingly careful how they send out words and thoughts that are so exceedingly bitter against anyone, whether in or out of the church. For their opponents, north and south, east and west, are watching them, trying to determine concerning spiritualism by the fruits those spiritualists bear. If they bear slander, what sort of notion can your opponents have concerning you or the glorious cause you represent? If their fruits are bitter, who can be nourished by them? No, no, ye spiritualists. Even ye who float only on the surface, beware. For this great cause that is, so far as its expression on earth is concerned, dependent on you for its growth, beware, I say, how you cause it to blush for you. The time may come when spiritualism will receive a sifting, when all such as are not spiritualists at heart, as well as at head, will be set aside, and by whom? Why, by the God of their own natures, for they will be ashamed of their course, because they will see it in its deformity, and they will set themselves aside, waiting till they shall be more worthy to enter the ranks of pure and undefiled spiritualism. We will answer a question in brief, which has been presented us from one of the liberal minds of the age, liberal, in certain directions, in politics, in religion, spiritualism excepted, for he tells us at the outset that he has not made up his mind as to whether or not spiritualism is true. He hopes it is true, thinks it is a glorious religion, hopes it may soon become exceedingly popular, and he might have added, when it does, I will openly embrace it. And then he asks what is our opinion, ours, the presiding spirits at the Banner of Light Rooms, with regard to universal suffrage. Tell us, he says, ye who profess to be spirits that have once lived in forms of flesh, whether you believe it is right for women to vote, whether you believe it is right for them to stand side by side, politically, morally, socially, and intellectually, with man. I am but one of many, therefore can only answer for myself as a distinct individuality. I claim to be responsible for all that I utter, and for nothing more. Is it right for women to vote? Is it best? Do you think they are capable of voting, and doing justice to themselves and their country? These were questions that passed through his mind, but found no external utterance. Our answer may be given in a very few words. If woman is capable of being a mother to those who make the laws of nations, if she is capable of training the young mind up to mature age, and shaping its physical, social, and intellectual destiny, surely she is capable of taking a part in politics. In very many instances she is man's intellectual superior, and I know that, when taken as a whole, she is in no way his inferior. It is only the superstition of past ages that has placed her upon a level below man. God never placed her there. Then has man the right to? Certainly not. And the same power that hath said, with regard to the black man, let my people go, says the same with regard to woman. Give her her freedom, in its largest and divinest sense. First, the religion in woman is opposed to war. She intuitively feels that peace is better than war. Woman, by nature, is better fitted to receive impressions from the higher and diviner life. Hence it is surely very possible that she may be so guarded and guided by that life, that she will make no mistake, even in casting her vote. Yes, as an individual, I am in favor of universal suffrage. I am in favor of bursting every kind of bonds. I am in favor of lifting the race higher, and still higher. But the great rushing tide of human progress is settling this question for you. I need not come to discuss it, whether I come or not, it will be discussed and settled. The same great power that determines concerning all things, also will determine concerning this, and since the dams that superstition has built against this great flood tide of human progress are being swept away, need we fear for the result? I certainly do not for one. I know that, as the race is bound to rise in all things, it will rise in this. And I know also that as the great Congress of Spirits are exerting now a widespread and deep-seated power on the earth, they will not overlook this most momentous question. By Bishop Fitzpatrick, of Boston, November 11, 1867. Question. We are told that Christ was of poor parentage. He, of course, had no opportunities for education. Yet he was able to confound the greatest Jewish doctors of his day. How do you account for this, if he was not divinely inspired? Answer. By the action of a natural law upon the physical body. I account for it as I would account for the same manifestation elsewhere. We are told, upon the very best of authority, that the lady subject, the medium through whom I am at present speaking to you, at 7 years of age held converse with men and women who were versed in the sciences of the times, and utterly confounded them with her wisdom. It was said to be some strange mystery, the brain was affected, but how, they did not see. At all events, a far greater amount of wisdom was given through her when under the inspiration of her guardian spirits, or entranced by them, than she could by any possibility have attained during her 7 years of earth life. Now you pass by these things that are taking place in your day. You go back 1800 years, to search for what was done through the man Jesus. You seek to worship the glory of the past, overlooking entirely the glory of the present. I do not censure anyone who cannot understand the glory of this great truth, which has burst upon the world in such refulgence. I do not blame those who sit in the shadow. I sat there, but a few months ago, myself. But I do most earnestly pray, that the sun may soon shine, and the darkness of the past, that has forced its way into the present, may soon be forced out by the glory of the present hour. This is my prayer, and, as I have faith in God, I believe it will be answered. By Thomas Paine, November 12, 1867. Question. Can we, after the spirit has left the body, appreciate and enjoy the beauties of nature and art with the same facility that we do now? And if so, then please say, can you, as individual spirits, in and of yourself, independently of any extraneous aid from any other source, a medium, for instance, take full and complete cognizance of any and all the beautiful scenes you were accustomed to frequent and admire while you were on earth? Answer. The soul is so constituted that it is able to take cognizance of whatever it is attracted unto under all circumstances. But, of necessity, there are a great variety of degrees. For instance, if when I was on earth observing through human senses the glory of a certain landscape, and having the power to remember that in my spiritual state, and the desire also to behold it again, I could not, without the aid of earthly senses, be able to take cognizance of the earthly part of the glorious picture. But I should be able to take cognizance of the more real, the more substantial, the more glorious part, which was the spirit. You have been taught by those who have returned, giving their views, their experience in the spirit world, that every material form has its inner life, its spiritual life, its divine representation, and that inner, that spiritual, that divine, corresponds to the external. God, I believe, would be very partial, exceedingly unjust, if he were to clothe the earth with so much grandeur and beauty, and deny the same blessing to the heavens. I have more faith in his wisdom. I believe his love extends beyond the boundaries of earth, more, I know it. Therefore, all that finds expression on the earth in natural form, finds expression also in the spirit land in spiritual form, which corresponds to the external, the natural. By Thomas Paine, November 14, 1867. Question. I saw in the AO Banner of Light, of September 14, an answer to the question pertaining to an intermediate state. The answer was, AO do not believe you will ever reach that condition of perfection, in the absolute, that so many souls are so earnestly seeking for. There will always be a haven of rest in the future, a something better than that you have reached. Now, I should like to ask, what process the soul, or spirit, has to undergo in making these several changes? And if the changes are as absolute and great as the change from the natural, or earth life, to the spiritual, or invisible life, as it is sometimes termed? And if so, does it teach the immortality of the soul? Answer. There are an infinite number, I believe, of very marked changes to be passed through in the spirit life. Similar to the chemical chance which has been termed death. The speaker, on the occasion referred to, answered the query for himself, and for himself alone. But there are thousands and tens of thousands of spirits who have laid aside the notion of ever being able to reach a point of perfection, or even of rest, from which there is no appeal. Indeed, all those spirits with whom your speaker has had the privilege of coming into mental relations, who have made the science of life a deepened soul study, have come to this determination. They believe in the eternal progress of the soul, and, believing this, they cannot see or realize any time or state of being wherein the soul can say to itself, I shall go no farther, I am content, but, on the contrary, the soul can only be happy by virtue of its own internal and external being, by constantly reaching out for something better than it has already found. Yes, good friend, you will find that, as a spirit disembodied, you will constantly be called upon to pass through changes distinct and marked, and changes that you will not in the external realize. By William E. Channing, November 19, 1867. Question. I saw in the banner, a few weeks since, this question, AO what are the functions of the spleen? Now, I would ask still further, what effect does a diseased spleen have upon the physical system generally? Answer. Medical men, who have made that branch of medical science a study, tell us that the spleen may be called the magnetic stomach, the organ that receives all the magnetic force that is necessary to assist in running the machine, the body, from outside conditions. It receives them, and by certain processes adapts them to the use of the body. They tell us, further, that a diseased spleen produces most disastrous effects throughout the entire body, because it vitiates the entire magnetic currents, and as it is upon them that all the other organs are dependent for natural vital connections, if that is not what it should be, the connection of all the organs is correspondingly imperfect. This being true, it is of the utmost importance to life that the spleen be in good order. Question. What connection is there between the phenomena, or prodigies of modern spiritualism, and the truths of religion and Christianity? Answer. Modern spiritualism is a natural, well-established truth. That truth which runs through Christianity is the same. They are all referable to the science of life. These and all other spiritual phenomena, of whatever class or kind, are all referable to the science of life. All may be resolved back to life. Question. Are not the words of a wise, honest, and good man, speaking from the fullness of a good and generous heart, superior to anything ever uttered by a medium, and far more trustworthy? Answer. No. Why should they be? If both are uttered from wise, good, honest standpoints, why should you exclude the moral validity of the one while you embrace the other? Truth is truth, from whatever source it comes, or through whatever channel it is given. Ignorance is ignorance. Wisdom is wisdom. I have seen just as great an exhibition of wisdom from the lips of childhood as I ever did from mature age. Sometimes the wisdom of a Solon may pale before the wisdom of childhood. Question. What is the practical utility, either morally or religiously, arising from such communications as were revealed at the last two circles? Answer. To some souls they demonstrate life after death. This was at page 88. This is of more importance than everything else combined. Christianity has never demonstrated the immortality of the soul. Modern spiritualism has done it, therefore it stands, in that respect, preeminently above Christianity. I mean that Christianity that is floating throughout the length and breadth of the land in the present day. I do not mean that pure and undefiled Christ spirit that is so entirely covered up with external observances and ceremonies that are called Christianity. I mean the life of all those vague ceremonies, which is entirely obscured by the external. I have faith that by and by this internal life, this pure principle of truth that has run through every religion, will finally work itself to the surface, will finally so clear itself from the clouds, from the superstition and darkness that surround it, as to be made apparent to the soul that seeks for pure, undefiled Christianity. The Christ Spirit teaches universal love. Do we find it with those who profess Christianity? No, we do not. On the contrary, they are very far removed from it. Christ taught his followers to love one another, the sacred law of love he sought to enforce upon all his followers. He constantly preached of love. It was the guiding star that led him on to glory. But, oh, where shall we find it among the churches who have taken his name today? We look for it in vain. By John Pierpont, November 21, 1867. Question. Is it true that thought takes form with spirits? In other words, if a spirit thinks, say, of a landscape, does their thought body forth to the spiritual sight a tangible presentation of the thing thought of? Answer. No, I do not so understand it. I believe that thought, in concert with action, can produce many, and, I may say, all the scenes of art. But I have no evidence that, by thinking of a beautiful flower, a beautiful landscape, or a beautiful face, in the spirit land or anywhere else, that the beautiful landscape, or flower, or face will be projected into existence simply because I have thought of it, or desire that it might come to me. The earth and the spirit land are filled with all that is essential to the soul's happiness. All the essential aids to spiritual progress are placed in the spirit land and in earth life, or wherever the spirit, as a spirit, can go. Now, as spirit is possessed of a very large degree, to say the least, of freedom when it casts off the mortal body, it is very reasonable to suppose, that if I think of a beautiful landscape, place, or thing, in my external life, I might commence action to reach that. I know in my soul life that it exists in tangible reality somewhere, and I seek it out. If my desire is strong enough, I do not stop till I reach it, till the object is gained, and I am thereby satisfied. In this sense, and, I believe, in this sense only, does thought produce external objects, or bring them to us. Question. If thought does not take form with the spirit, then is it true that the objectivities of the spirit world appear fixed and permanent, as with us on earth? For instance, three persons, with us, look at the objects in a room, and we all see the same things. Is the correspondence of this true with spirits? Answer. Yes, certainly. No two persons see or understand a thing exactly alike. You should remember that, and where you have that faculty of perception very poorly developed here, the spirit, in its enfranchised condition, has it very largely developed. For instance, I may say that is a very poor painting, a perfect daub. Somebody else may say, that is perfectly beautiful, it is food. For my soul. These soul feelings, for they belong to the soul here, belong to it, to a very large degree, in the spirit world. They have the largest room for the exercise of that freedom which belongs to the spirit after it has cast off the body. Therefore, if I detest the picture here, and see no beauty in it, that feeling will be intensified in the spirit world. Consequently, two spirits returning from the same spiritual locality will give you entirely different accounts of that locality. One will say it is beautiful, another that it is a barren waste. The capacity to understand is within, the variety is without, but the capacity to enjoy the variety is from within. So you see, no two individuals can understand anything, not even any one thought, exactly alike. There will be a difference of opinion, because there is a difference in the internal constitution of the individual. For it is by the internal that the external is measured. Question. Why do not the spirit friends of those who may be present at a seance in the circle room manifest, instead of those who have no personal friends present? Answer. It is not thought best to allow such manifestation. First, because it would prove a great draft upon the medium, too great. Secondly, because the public, the skeptical public, would say, oh, it comes from the audience. The larger portion of those who manifest are friends in the audience. It is but the reflection of their mind. So it has been determined that the instances of spirit manifestations to those who have friends in the audience shall be very few. Indeed, all will be debarred from coming, except such as can do so upon an entirely platonic plane. If you could stand behind the scenes and watch all the modes operandi of this thing, you would not wonder that the guardians of these seances have considered it best to take such a course. And again, those who manifest are generally, the majority, at all events, those who cannot reach their friends by any other process. Their friends are skeptical, and will not meet them at any other place where they can speak. And this is the only place from which they can give publicity to their manifestations and reach their friends. By William E. Channing, November 25, 1867. Question. I understand from the controlling spirit that there is no forgiveness for sin, that an inevitable penalty follows every transgression of any law of our being. What becomes of the penalty when pains are removed and diseases healed? Answer. Returning spirits always inform you, such as have been informed themselves upon this point, that there is no forgiveness for sins. Every sin begets its own judge, and the judge begets the punishment therefore. The three are so closely allied you cannot separate them. When you commit a sin against your physical nature, suffering is the consequence. When you commit a sin against your spiritual nature, spiritual suffering is the consequence. You produce punishment, a state of inharmony, and, as the spirit lives in heaven only by living in harmony, when it lives in the opposite it lives in hell, whether on the earth, under the earth, or in the skies. When it is in an inharmonious condition it is in hell. There are many degrees of inharmony, as of harmony. There are many degrees of heaven, as of hell. The child suffers a certain degree of hell by unconsciously outraging the laws of its physical being. The law does not excuse the little one because it does not understand the law. It acts precisely the same with their child as with the adult. It is no respecter of persons or of ages. The little one falls beneath its stroke as mature or old age falls beneath its stroke. It never fails to visit justice and judgment upon all who place themselves in antagonism to it. Your correspondent asks how it is in the case of cures performed by certain healing agents upon the earth. There is an end unto all conditions of existence. Conditions are changeable, they end that they may give place to others. Disease, inharmony, are but the conditions of life, subject to change. When the punishment has been severe enough, the change comes. When the suffering one has suffered to an extent sufficient to induce him or her to seek the proper remedy, then there is a time to change. The spirit has received chastisement sufficient for the time, therefore salvation steps in consequence of the exercise of reason. Now, when the criminal descends lower and still lower in crime, when his spirit has been deluged again and again with that which follows crime, that mental suffering, that unrest, that dissatisfaction, when, I say, it has been deluged again and again, by and by it begins to reason. The God without says to the God within, come, now, and let us reason together. And the result is, the man or woman begins to feel that there is a better way, and that that way is for them as for others. They begin to seek to know of that way, to understand it, to walk in it, to pass out of the darkness of the present and enter the light of the future, and then begins a newer existence. Then the fogs and mists and inharmonies that are the result of crime begin to pass away, and the soul begins to be resurrected from it. Is it by a direct interposition of the great All-Father without in the universe? It may be, but we believe that there. Spirit rests, progresses, and leaves the world by virtue of that glorious germ of progression that the Infinite has implanted within it. The germ cannot always remain in darkness. It will eventually find its way to the light, and eventually disperse the shadows. Question. I understand that the controlling spirit has stated that sometimes people can be cleansed from immoralities in a somewhat corresponding manner as diseases are cured. How can such things be, without forgiveness? Answer. Forgiveness is a term which your correspondent seems to have defined according to his own understanding. To us, forgiveness is a something which avails without suffering. For instance, I place my hand in the fire. The fire does not burn. Forgiveness steps in between the action on my part and the action of the law. The fire does not burn. That is my idea of what forgiveness is. Now if I lace my hand in the fire, and the fire burns, and I make use of the usual remedies to stay the progress of the burn, does it follow that I have been forgiven because the fire did not burn my hand up entirely? Surely not. You will learn, every one of you, sooner or later, that there is no forgiveness of sin, either in this world or the next. So sure as you place yourself in antagonism to the law, so sure it will smite you. There is no forgiveness. If you sin against the law of your own reason, there is no forgiveness therefore till you have paid the uttermost farthing for your wrongdoing. Question. Do clairvoyants and mediums retain and exercise the same or a corresponding power in the spirit world as they have here? Answer. They do, only the power is largely increased by the change. This was at page 94. Question. I desire to know if the following speculations, extracted from Sawyer's Mental Philosophy, published in 1839, are true? A.O. When divested of the organs of sense at death, the mind is thrown back upon the hands of God, to be provided with such other capacities as he sees fit to bestow. Its introduction to the other state, at death, will doubtless be analogous to its introduction to the present state at birth, so far as the bestowment of new capacities and powers is concerned. The powers and capacities requisite for the life to come will, no doubt, in like manner be conferred at death, the period of our being born into another world. Death divests us entirely of all the organs of sense, and, consequently, of all capacity for experiencing sensation of any kind. Our birth into another world will probably invest us with other capacities of a similar but higher nature. Answer. The ground taken there is substantially correct. The spirit receives, at its second birth, new capacities. It casts off all that it has no further use for, and receives what it can use in the spirit world. The change is distinct, so much so, that could you discern the spirit, in its true, spiritual state after death, you would be led to exclaim, O God, how great the change! And yet the change is so simple that a little child instinctively understands it. When a child is born into this mundane sphere, its first effort is to inhale the atmosphere. Nature acts in conjunction with the wisdom of the great Infinite who rules in nature. The child breathes here because there is a necessity for it. One born into the spirit land breathes in a different way, because there is need of a different way. There are other attributes added to the soul in the spirit world than those it possesses here, because it finds it will need them in the higher life. This was at page 95. As it advances, It receives more and still more. It passes out of the old, it instinctively embraces the new, and so on throughout all eternity. I believe it will be ever changing in the external, but in the internal remaining forever and forever the same. Question.